I think we should get started, even though a few more people might be joining us. But I think because this is such a hot topic, I want to make sure we spend as much time as we can on the conversation at hand. So let me welcome all of you to our fourth Peer Training Network call of 2007. I'm Susan Kanak from the National Resource Center for Organizational Improvement at the Muskie School in Portland, Maine, and I'm so glad that you would join our call today. This peer training network is comprised of folks who are interested in child welfare training. As those of you who have been listening to the introductions have heard, some members are trainers, some are curriculum writers, some manage training, some are academics, some are with state agencies, some are with county with universities. Most of us do, however, a little bit of everything. As some of you might remember, this network started 4 years ago to give folks interested in exchanging ideas on child welfare training a forum and an opportunity to meet and talk together. Since in this network are people interested in learning from each other and getting and giving feedback on various child welfare topics. This really is a peer network. Network members set the topics for our calls, suggest the presenters, if there are any presenters, and actively share their thoughts, experiences, and lessons learned on the topic of the day. This peer training network offers many opportunities to connect child welfare trainers across the country. What we have in common is an interest in improving the lives of children and families through effective training, and an interest in providing ideas and support to each other. So I'm pleased that each and every one of you is a member of this group. We usually do a roll call, but since it took 10 minutes to get us through the roll call and we've sort of identified who's on the call already, I think I'm going to skip that for today. And basically, let us get right into the topic for today's call, which is training evaluation. And I want to thank Marty Lowry for suggesting this topic. Marty, do you remember a couple months ago when you said it would be good to have a call on training evaluation?
I did, and I'm thrilled that we're having an opportunity to do it.
Yes, thank you for the idea, and obviously it was a really hot topic. I got a number of emails from folks who are new to the network, who wanted to join this call, and I also received emails and calls from a number of people who could not make the call today but wanted to hear the information. So in something that's a bit unusual for our peer training network, we are we are taping this call. And it will be available for download at the Resource Center's website. I think it usually takes a week to 10 days to get the files up there, but please feel free to take advantage of this opportunity to have this call available to you and share it with anybody that you would like to share it with. So with that as introductory remarks, let me introduce to you, although I'm not sure I really need to, Anita Barbie. Anita, as most of you know, is one of the, if not the gurus, in child welfare training and evaluation in the nation. Anita shares her wisdom and enthusiasm for this topic openly, honestly, and continuously, and has educated me, and I know many of the people on this call, about what, how you might think about training evaluation. Anita is a professor at the Kent School of Social Work at the University of Louisville, an expert in child welfare training evaluation, program evaluation, and organizational development. She's agreed to start our call off by giving us a framework about training evaluation, and then presenting what's new in child welfare evaluation, training evaluation around the country. After that, we'll have an open discussion so you all can ask questions, share what you're doing, share what you're learning. If you're facing any particular struggles, I'd encourage you to bring them up on the call today so your colleagues and Anita can perhaps give you some ideas and information. Please join me in welcoming Anita to our call today. We're fortunate to have her, and let me turn this over to Anita. You ready to go?
Sure, and I'm just so glad that my Southern accent will be recorded and on the web.
Yes.
I'm actually kidding, because I don't realize how Southern I am until I hear it on a recording like that. What I wanted to do there, I think everyone has two handouts that we sent out with the announcement of this particular call, and one is just a little pictorial view of how we've done training evaluation in Kentucky, and a number of states are beginning to pick up on this model as a way to approach training evaluation, and then the other sheet is just talking about the components of this particular model in a little bit of English. I've drawn on the work that we've done and also the work of Jane Birdie and Cindy Perry. Jane Birdie was with American Humane Association in Colorado. Now she's an independent consultant, and so is Cindy Perry. Cindy's up in Montana, and they've talked a lot about the chain of evidence and creating a chain of evidence from the organization and the workers who are involved in learning and being in a training environment, and how that chain can be captured all the way out to outcomes for children and families, and that it's important to gather information on every step of the way rather than jumping steps. Because I know a lot of people are interested in transfer of training to the field and outcomes for families and children, but you've got to have some other pieces in place before you go that far out. Otherwise, you don't know why you get the outcomes you do. So basically what we try to measure and what we how we conceptualize training evaluation is realizing that training is in the context of a whole organization. That's why organizational improvement takes the lead on training for the Children's Bureau, because training is a piece of that organization and a piece of making practice happen, and needs to be an integral piece in that, in ensuring that best practices are taught, and trying to communicate with the rest of the organization to support the training that goes on. And so we try to measure those pieces. So far we've only been able to measure that from the perspective of the person in the training. For example, how much they feel supported by their supervisor and their coworkers in learning what they're learning in the training, their perceived support for that, how they view the organization and its culture and its culture around learning, and then what they bring to the table in terms of their readiness for learning and some of the traits that they carry with them in terms of being able to carry out the information that they receive. So those are kind of the predictor variables of whether training is going to stick or not. And then, of course, the training itself needs to be looked at to make sure that there's fidelity of the training material across people who receive it, that the curriculum is written in a way that incorporates adult learning techniques and clear goals and outcomes, and it also includes pieces as well as knowledge, and that people are kind of complying and are able to carry it off. And so there's a number of measures to look at the training itself. And then what a lot of people really focus on when they're doing training evaluation is how it kind of impacts the learner. And those are those training outcomes. And there's been a theory out there for the last 60 years by Kirkpatrick looking at levels of training evaluation. And that's where you pick up on how much the trainees, how they react to the training itself, whether they think it's useful or they feel good about it, how much they learn immediately and how much they retain of that learning, that knowledge gain, and how they are able to or not to transfer that knowledge as they develop relationships with clients and as they perform their work in both in documentation and in practice behaviorally. And then you can begin, if you've measured all those things, how the organization supports or doesn't support training, what the trainee brings to it, how the training cycle has been executed, that those different levels of reaction, learning, and transfer, then you can begin to try to tie it to that final chain in the chain of evidence, which is the organizational outcomes, such as safety, permanency, and well-being for child welfare. Sometimes there's other measures, but that's what we've tried to do, is to create that measures to measure each piece of that process so that we have that chain all the way out to practice. And we've had a lot of success in showing that training can really, in the right circumstances, have good impacts on practice and outcomes for families. And we can talk about the struggles of doing that and how expensive it is and all those kinds of things. But that's basically what we do and what we try to promote. We've got measures for all those different pieces along the cycle that we can share with people. Susan, is that what you wanted me to say, or is there something else you want me to talk about?
No, I think that's a good start. Could you, though, go back a little bit and talk a little bit more about some of the predictors?
Okay. Let me talk about it in terms of what we found.
Good. Excellent.
To help you, to make it more concrete. So, for example, when a person is sitting in the training room as a participant, if they're not ready to learn, meaning motivated to learn, kind of conscientious, caring about the material, caring about their work, focused in on the work, they won't learn anything. And so we have a whole measure called learning readiness that picks up on those components of a person's willingness and ability to learn. And that predicts how much people actually gain in knowledge and then how much they then transfer that knowledge to their practice. So that's been a big predictor that we found impacts. And, of course, trainers will always tell you that because they can, you know, stand on their head and be as exciting, as wonderful, and have the best material in the world. But if the learner is not ready to learn it or doesn't have a good attitude about it, they're not going to do it, and they're not going to learn. And so we can't put everything on the trainer. It's not just their role to facilitate learning. The learner has to be willing to engage in that learning process. So we measure that. The other thing we look at is their view of their supervisor. We have a questionnaire that asks about, has the supervisor talked to you about what's going on in training? Have they been glad to let you have the time to go to training? Are they reinforcing the ideas after training? Are they eager to hear what you're learning? Do they value training in general? And the same kind of questions about the team, the other people that the learner is learning with. And so, again, we found that supervisory and team support facilitates actual getting the material into your head and learning as well as transfer. So we found in our own research that those have a huge impact on outcomes in practice and having the learning stick.
So what you're saying then really is that there's work that needs to be done by the supervisor to help the learner get ready to come to a class. And that might be things like talking about what's the importance of participating in this training and what they hope that the worker will get out of the training and things like that. And that really can help avoid those dreadful situations that every trainer on this call has had when you go around the room and you say to the participants, so what are you hoping to get out of this session? And they say, I don't know. I was just told to show up here, and here I am. So, and that's happened to me, and I know that's happened to other folks on this call. And the supervisor can help avoid that.
Right. And what happens is if they are reporting that the supervisor is supportive before training, we followed up and found that those supervisors are more likely to help reinforce the training, and that's where the transfer happens. People can go to a classroom training and learn a lot, but in terms of transfer, they need the support of their supervisors and their coworkers to actually enact that new knowledge and skill.
Before and after.
Yes.
Okay.
We've sometimes been able to measure it after, but it's correlated. So if they're in an environment where everybody's enthusiastic about training and believes in training and is supporting it, they also are supporting what's learned in the practice and helping reinforce it afterwards.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can I just ask a quick question before we move on from this too much? You mentioned that you measure the learning readiness. Can you share how do you go about measuring that in the beginning?
We have a scale that measures it. It's called the Learning Readiness Inventory.
Is that something that's readily available? Or
that particular one is my colleague's that has it copyrighted, but it's inexpensive. So we can figure out a way to get that to you all.
If people ask for it. Is that a pre-test?
We do it during the pretest. We give a battery of tests before, at the beginning of training, along with the pre-knowledge test.
Anita, would it be possible to have a post-test that was related to assess, evaluate attitudes about the training after it occurred?
Yes, you can do both. And we've done that before. And partly when we do the feelings of utility and affect about the training, that level one measure, we include questions like that sometimes that pick up on how receptive the person was. And what we find is that people who are more ready also see the training as more useful. The utility is higher, and utility really has an impact on transfer. And affect, if you like the trainer and the training in the whole atmosphere, you're more likely to change attitudes. So affect affects attitudes, and utility affects behavior.
And so maybe this is a whole different phone call, but what do you do with that information? Because we know, this is Holly in Arizona, we're so desperate in terms of hiring people that we know we get a bunch that they either think they know it all or they're one foot is already looking for another job, and so they're not very ready and interested in learning, and their supervisors are so overloaded that they don't want them to come to training. They want them to stay there and take cases. So as an organization, then, do you have a mechanism that you do something about that?
We have shared the information with our state that about half of the people are not ready.
Oh, okay.
Or are low on conscientiousness. That's the other measure we've used.
Okay.
And we have tried unsuccessfully to get our own and other states to begin to do better screening of potential employees.
Okay.
Because we know what predicts good practice and staying with the agency retention.
Right.
And if people would, on the front end, hire the better people as they come along.
Right.
And then retain them, then you wouldn't have the turnover, and eventually it would begin to reverse itself.
Right. I mean,
but because people aren't lining up to be child welfare workers, and there isn't a lot of choice and the caseloads are mounting, we haven't been able to get a lot of footage on that yet.
Okay.
But that is where the field needs to go.
At least that's a little bit validating, although sad.
Yeah, I know. It really is sad because it really does matter who you have in these jobs.
Yeah, it
and,
does.
And training can only do so much. So in some ways, it just reassures the trainers that you can only do so much with what you've got.
Yeah.
And it gets them off the hook, in a sense, because it's only as good as the people you've got sitting there.
Right.
What we've also done is tried to engage supervisors in our supervisory training that part of their role is to get people ready.
Yeah, we have
to reinforce and support. And that's as much as we've been able to do.
Okay.
But we would like for states, if somebody would like to pilot that, let me know. And we've got a measure of that's a good selection measure for child welfare workers. We just need to pilot it and test it out in the state and begin to show the results, because we are certain it would make a difference.
I might. We're working. I'll email you or something, because we have the Cornerstone for Kids project, workforce development project, that's working, has chosen our state to work with, and part of that is a hiring for fit initiative.
Uh-huh.
So
okay.
That might fit into it all.
Let me know how I can help.
Yeah, thanks.
But, yeah, we don't give anyone that information. It's private. We don't, like, say, these are your unmotivated workers.
Right.
We don't share that. That's
okay.
For research purposes. But it has told us a lot about what we've got going on in child welfare systems.
Okay. Cool. Thank you.
Sure.
Anita, this is Cindy.
Hey.
Hi. I was just wondering, too, if maybe some of the work that Michelle and Frida do with the realistic job preview would be helpful.
The in-basket tasks? Is that what they have?
No, I was thinking more in terms of the hiring where they try to up front give people a realistic preview of what they're getting into.
We made one of those, too, in Arizona, and that actually has helped quite a bit. It has screened out some people up front, so because I've seen a difference in the classroom since then.
Cindy or Holly, this is Susan. For those of us who only have a slight idea what you're talking about, can you give me a few words on what the realistic job preview is? Because I think all of us would really agree that hiring the right people really does help the training and obviously help the practice. But what are you talking about in terms of realistic job previews, if you don't mind?
Oh, sure. And Nebraska has one, too. And then last year we did our own, and it actually turned out really well. And what they did is to interview workers and supervisors all over the state and to have them talk about the work that they do and the challenges and how hard it is and the hours and, you know, the emotional stress and also the rewards. And, you know, several of them were long-term workers and what it is that makes them stay. So, and it because it has to be really balanced. You don't want to give a rosy view.
Right,
you want
or
to talk
the
about the truly, the, I mean, there are a lot of intrinsic rewards, but we wanted them to also know, you know, what are some of the challenges because, for instance, sometimes people get into this work saying, oh, I just love working with children. and then the reality is you have to work with the parents that abuse them. And so things like that where they're really talking, it was just interview after interview after interview. And then they did also have a family, in fact, two families that were interviewed who had successfully gone through services and got their children back from CPS and had a good case manager and a good experience and what was important to them about that and what they needed from their case manager. Let me see who else was in it.
And then, Holly, is this all summarized up into a video or something that you preview with people you're interviewing?
Yes, it was summarized into a video, and it was we have a video department, but they did it really professionally, and it is on our website. If you were going to go and apply for a job, then it will direct you to preview that video. And if you end up just coming to a job fair and you haven't seen it, they sit you down in a room and have you watch it.
That's good.
So basically everybody, before they come into the job, has seen that. And some have selected out, you know, by self-selected out by, I guess that's not what I thought it was. I don't want to do that kind of work.
And can you give us that website?
I'm working from home today, but I will absolutely send it to you.
That'd be great.
And you'll want to also talk to, or we'll find some information to help you contact Michelle and Frida, one from Nebraska and one from Maine, who've helped create those for those states.
Sure.
You know, we might want to do a separate call on this.
Mm-hmm. That would be good.
I didn't mean to sidetrack us. Then.
This is Michigan, and we also have the same sort of film. We ship out a DVD ahead of time, and we found it to be very helpful.
Oh, great. Okay. I think we are going to put this on the
next. Yeah, that's really great.
And Susan?
Yes.
This is Kathy McIntosh.
Hi, Kathy.
We haven't made one yet. It's on our list, but we do have one. I do have a copy of the one from North Carolina.
Okay.
That I just have to say is terrific. It really will make you laugh, make you cry, make you, you know, really think about why are we in the business.
Cool.
That's great.
Susan and Anita, this is Jerry Sopko from Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania also has one. So if there's going to be any effort, I guess, to
form
a repository for all of them.
This is wonderful. This is terrific. And for those of you who have them or have used in other states, can you, like, borrow them? Copy them, borrow them, use them yourself? Kathy McIntosh, when you say you borrowed North Carolina's, do you show theirs, or did you take it to get ideas for yourself?
Well,
or both?
Both, a little bit. Some of the regions are using it. They let us make copies of it. They sent us some copies and just gave us really good permission to use it. My hope is we'd be able to do one of our own, and I think, like, from Arizona, they're saying they had families who are part of that, then, because we'd like to have some families involved and some of our youth involved with that.
Oh, that's great.
This is wonderful. This is wonderful. Well, I've got this down as a topic for a next call, and certainly, Jerry, I love your idea of us putting a list together of who's got these videos. So if you've got one and you're willing to share it, send me that information, and I will email it out to the group. How's that?
And I think it's not just good for recruitment, you know, and helping some of that pre-screening, self-selection, but I think it's good for retention.
Yes.
I think people really have enjoyed seeing this.
Okay, great.
That's great. Yeah, because what we've done in Kentucky is focus more on the BSWs and doing that pre-employment public certification program where we have 2 years to get them ready. Mm-hmm. In a school of social work, and then we hire them into the agency, but they've done their placement, so they do know from direct experience what's going on. But this is great because you can't always get all social workers or all people who have some notion of what this job is. This is a great tool to help with the screening.
Yeah, that was our situation, too, is we hire, I'm sure it's like way less than 50% BSWs.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Thank you. This has really been terrific. Anita, can you walk us through what is on your outline? And that's the training evaluation measures. Talk about each of the four levels, because I know everybody, I think, is familiar with the participant reaction and the pre- and post-learning test. Maybe you could talk about the value of all of those. If you're trying to get us to think about building a chain of evaluation evidence, what's the value of each of these steps? Because I've heard a lot of people recently kind of laughing at and demeaning that level one evaluation. And while I know that's not a place to stop, I've always thought you can get some useful information right from the get-go by asking people what they thought about a particular event right after the event.
Yeah. You don't want to leave it out because... Well, there's several pieces of value. One, it gives information to the trainers on how they're being perceived.
Yep.
Trainers like to look at that, and it gives them some sense of how they're coming across and whether people, you know, like the different things they've done or whether the techniques are working or whatever pieces they put into that measure. And it also, again, you don't want to skip a step because if they don't learn for some reason, you're not sure why. You're not sure if it's because they weren't engaged or the right kinds of learning, you know, mechanisms were used or strategies, or if they didn't see it as useful. So that's why another reason why you want to have all the pieces, because you don't want to leave out something that will give you information about why you might get lower or higher results on a particular measure.
Okay.
The other thing, again, as we've said, if they like the training, they're more likely to change attitudes. So if you're focused on cultural competency or diversity or trying to help workforce feel more sympathetic or empathetic towards families that have substance abuse issues or domestic violence or whatever it is you're working on, if you have an attitudinal component, training in a way that engages people, that makes them feel good about the training, is more likely to change the attitude. If you want to change behavior, the utility is important. If they don't think it's useful, they don't see how it ties to their job, they're not going to use it.
Right.
So you do need to measure that to make sure that those components are showing up in the outcome for the level one. And Cindy's on the call, so she can really talk a lot about the learning, but certainly, if you try to jump to transfer of how they're doing in the field without knowing what they learned in the class, you can't really say it was because of training. It could be a million other things that affect their practice. You want to be able to say at the end of training, at the end of the day, they've learned something. It may not be 100% or every little piece of information you've given them, but you want some indication that what they came in with kind of sets your baseline of what they knew coming in, and at the end what they know coming out of the training shows, you know, at least some modicum of idea of what they've picked up on and what they can kind of maybe carry out with them. Although
now
that
you use that just for information, for a note to inform, but you're not using that to say, okay, as a criterion based, where you say, you know what, you don't know enough to do the job, so
no.
You're not attempting to use it in that way, right?
Not in Kentucky. Some states have tried that to certify their workforce, and that the level of the test has to be here's the difficulty. With training content changes frequently. So you have a valid test, and with every change in the training curriculum, content, or goals, the test has to change, and then it takes time to revalidate it. So it's
crazy.
A constant process of revalidating the test.
Right.
And so it's hard to keep it at the highest level of validation, although some people have probably been more successful than we have. Again, Cindy can speak to that. But has the training itself, again, covered the content and been engaging enough and used the adult learning techniques for people to learn. And that test shows how the training is doing, not so much the worker themselves. It's not focused at that level. It's training evaluation, not worker performance.
Okay.
There are ways.
This is Kristen O'Dell from Portland State.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, one of the things I was wondering about if you could address was what safeguards or things that you put in place or how you worked with the state or the union to protect the workers from somebody coming and asking how a particular worker did on a test or that kind of thing?
And again, we don't have a union, and the states we work with don't have unions. So I'm not sure. I know that New York has done a lot of testing. I'm not sure exactly how they've dealt with the unions. Probably, again, we focus mostly on evaluating training itself rather than the workers themselves, although there have been times in our history in Kentucky where we've shared the results with not only the worker so they'll know how they did, but the supervisor, so that the supervisor knows. And we did it in the couching of how to help them learn and grow more. So we would tell them what the content of the training was, show how the worker did compared to other workers, where they were strong, where they might have some weaknesses, and then gave suggestions for remediation, like send them to some online modules or some videotapes in your office, or maybe they need to come back through the training for those that particular piece. And that's been times when the political environment wanted that and other times that haven't. So it's just depended on what the state wants. We've been able to sometimes give feedback. No one's ever been fired because of it. It just helps sometimes for people to know, gauge what they're getting. But really these tests aren't at that level. They're really focused on evaluating the training itself, not the trainees.
So you're aggregating the results of the group for each of
the trainers get the aggregate, and the worker gets their own report just for their own information, so they can just see how they did on different pieces of the test. The tests are divided out into sections, and so they'll have a score in each section, and they can see, example, where they're strong and where they're weak and where they might need more information so that they can do better. But again, that's just kind of a courtesy just to give them some information since they've taken the time to take all these tests. But mostly we're feeding it back to the training branch folks and the trainers so that they can improve their delivery of the material.
Okay,
Anita?
Thank you.
This is Cindy. I'm sorry, I didn't hear who asked the question, but one of the things that we've dealt with in the work we're doing in California with their statewide evaluation is
deals, we've dealt with this same issue of we want this to evaluate training, not the trainees, but we have to collect ID information in order, for example, to link the pre and the post test. So how are we going to protect that from being used in ways that we don't intend it to be used?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the solutions that we came up with, which is not perfect, but it seems to be working okay, is a self-generated ID. And only the trainee knows who they are, but we use sort of a combination of mother's maiden name, initials, and birth date, and they can regenerate that fairly easily with some instructions every time without forgetting what they said last time. But no one else knows who they are. And we do get a few dupes that way, but we've cut that down by extending the ID generation process. And it's working okay. And that way no one actually can come back and say, give us your data. We'd like to see it. I mean, they can have it, but it won't. It still protects people's
tell
identity.
Anything. Mm-hmm. That's good.
I like that.
Of course, then you can't follow them into their practice or the outcomes for the families, but I don't even know if California has that kind of capability.
We aren't there yet, but you can't connect up to a data system, like a FECWA system, and look at outcome data for families. That is a disadvantage.
Yeah.
I had one other question. We were wondering about how or what kinds of things you have in place for, like, people who maybe are English isn't their first language, or maybe they have a learning disability or some reason why they're not going to do well on a test. What are there types of things that you've done to address that?
Again, because we're looking at this as a overall measure across lots of people to see if training's coming across in general, we haven't worried too much about that because we also, in Kentucky, we have other measures of learning like self-report rating several months later on key behaviors and ratings by the supervisor on how well they're practicing and looking at case records to see how they're implementing the information in their actual casework. So we've got other ways to kind of see how the training is having an impact and if individual learners have those kind of issues. Again, since we're not assessing the learner, we're not as concerned about that. If we ever got to that point, you would need to give accommodations. We've also given these tests, and other people in the country have given tests different ways. Sometimes they do it just a piece of paper in the classroom. Sometimes it's online. We've used a lot of online test that people have time to complete information. It's not a timed test, so if they need to spend more time on it. And then other times the people have used those systems where they use the clicker system. I can't remember the formal name for that, where questions will come up and then people click their answer. They don't have to write or do those other things. So maybe those different testing methods could also help. Cindy, have you ever kind of dealt with that?
Well, we do ask people about English as a second language as part of the demographic forms that we do.
Uh-huh.
But again, we're not doing certification of individuals, so we're looking at the learning as a whole, just like Anita is. And what I'm finding is that in terms of just learning, the ESL people aren't differing any from the people who have English as a first language, but we're not looking at their absolute level of score on the test when they leave. We're looking at how much they've learned from pre to post.
Right.
And so, you know, an absolute level, it might be lower. I can't speak to that question. And I think, you know, you're right, Anita, that you would have to make accommodations if you were going to do something with certification or some kind of high-stakes testing where there were individual results. And the APA and a couple of other organizations put out a test construction manual, and they have a section in there on requirements for accommodations. If anybody is in that situation, there are resources that you can check out for ideas.
And probably Cindy would agree with me. We don't recommend high-stakes testing because it's so difficult to have the perfect test that can stand up in court, and it's not necessarily going to give you that much of a gain. We rather see training as a developmental process and that this information gives feedback to the training system to improve the system. And if we can find, and that's why the way training is carried out is so important, using different kinds of methods of training and methods of getting the information across and reinforcing in the field. All those different pieces are to try to improve everyone rather than having this heavy worry over everyone's head that they're going to either make a cutoff or not.
Yeah.
Anita and Cindy. Hi, Cindy. This is Susan.
Hi, Susan.
Thank you for joining the call. High-stakes testing, quick two-word definition, three-word definition?
Something where there are personnel consequences, where you need to be certified to stay in a job or to advance, or you know, you might get fired if you don't pass the test.
Okay, that's certainly high stakes. Thank you.
Yeah. And would part of that, because I've had these repeated requests, and I just tell them this is, you know, not what we do at this time, it's Holly in Arizona, of like MSW students and people from another state wanting to test out of things.
Uh-huh.
And we don't have a we don't have a test for it because of everything you just said. And B, you know, so much of it, it's culled down now to where there's not very much generic stuff. It's basically how do you do the job in Arizona.
Right.
And a lot of the MSW students are, frankly, kind of arrogant, and they feel that they should be able to test out.
And one way you can, I mean, one way we've sometimes used pretests is as a learning tool. Of here's the information we kind of expect you to know what you're going to be learning over this period of time. There have been times when we're not really using it so much for evaluation, but just as a tool.
That's a good idea.
And give the feedback.
Yeah.
And then people can see what they don't know, which is a lot.
Yeah.
Because our average scores on pretests, and this includes bachelors of social work, you know, people with, we have a related degrees in Kentucky, and sometimes they even have masters. We don't find a lot of difference in the pre.
No, we really don't either.
And they're averaging, you know, 65 on a pretest.
Yeah.
So people, you know, aren't brilliant coming in.
Yeah.
Because a lot of it is policy and just specifics to this particular field of practice that people haven't always been exposed to. So that sometimes will humble people. And help them be more motivated to learn and to listen and to get engaged. And you can use that even with your evaluation if you have different tests at pre and post. You've got a kind of a range of items that you can pull from that are equally difficult and equally covering the material. There are ways to do that, and then you can share the results with them. Use that as part of the motivation.
Okay. Thank you.
And can I just add one thing? This is Kathy McIntosh from Kansas. You know, we've been working with our universities, and one of the things they are quite adamant about is that they do not teach child welfare.
Right.
They teach general social work practice.
That's what our
These are generalist degrees.
Uh-huh.
And we only hire at least BSWs.
Mm-hmm.
So too, but that's been just very consistent, and much to some of our frustration, we'd like that to be a little bit different. But it really does mean that we cannot expect the people coming in to have a good understanding of some of the things we're facing in child welfare.
Right.
They really do. What they have are values and some practice skills in general, like how to do an interview.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
But they don't have the specifics. So that is something to remember. Don't assume just because they have a BSW that they know it. That's good. The other piece here on this sheet about learning, and again, Cindy can talk about this more than we've done. We haven't done it so much is having practice sessions in the training to get to kind of have an embedded evaluation where you actually observe skills in the training and show kind of improvement over time. In the training itself is another measure of learning or learning of skills. And Cindy and people, I think, in Pennsylvania and Illinois and Colorado have used that technique. Cindy, can you tell them a little bit about that?
Sure. One of the things that we've worked on quite a bit is trying to embed a skill evaluation in a classroom practice activity because it usually takes a long time to evaluate skill, especially if it's interactional skill, where you're looking at interviewing, say, and you're looking at a role play and how people are asking questions. It can be very time-consuming. So what we've tried to do is build evaluation into a classroom practice activity so that it also reinforces the learning and it's not time spent just on evaluation. I don't know if it would help to give an example, but in California right now we're doing one with child maltreatment identification where it's vignettes, and they read the vignettes, and then they go through and they've learned 13 points that they need to consider in evaluating whether or not physical abuse is occurring, and they analyze the vignette in terms of those 13 points. We collect the data, and then they do a debriefing discussion and reinforce the learning again of the points. So that's the kind of thing that we're talking about with embedded eval. And somebody brought up before the idea of reaching a criterion of performance rather than just showing an improvement. And usually when we do these, that's the kind of measure that we're looking at. We're looking at a criterion of performance because we don't get the chance to do these, you know, several times during a training usually and look at changes. What we do is we have usually an expert group say, here's what we would like to see in terms of performance on this task, and then we evaluate people against the standard. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
that's good.
It does. Uh-huh.
That's good.
So if you know that they feel good about the training and have found it useful, that they've learned something from pre to post, and that they're learning or they're reaching certain skill levels in the training, then you can begin to talk about or look at transfer. Once you've measured those two and maybe some of those predictive variables if you can, then you can begin to follow people over time, give, you know, surveys several months or, you know, 3, 6, 12 months out, asking about their perceptions of what they learned, asking about their comfort level or their how well they're doing in particular behaviors, having their supervisors rate them or other people rate them, having people observe them in the field, or looking at their actual casework. We've done a lot of reviews of cases. Sometimes it's pre-post if training happens later than it should. Sometimes it's just looking for a tie to the we develop a particular measure that picks up on what's trained to see if they're kind of complying with the training. So there's lots of different ways you can look at transfer. Some are inexpensive and some are very expensive.
Anita, are you still, when you're doing, this is Susan again, the transfer of learning, are you still evaluating the training or are you now beginning to look at worker performance when you've hit the transfer level?
Again, we get enough people in the sample to, again, look at the training. So we tie the training event, the learning, and the same people who were in that training event, how they're doing in the field. So it's all, again, the same people, but you're looking at that tie back to the training event. And you look at it like a number of cases and a number of people across time to see how well your training system is doing in teaching a certain skill set, for example, or policy or whatever. Go ahead.
Who does all of that evaluation for you?
I'm the evaluation leader, and we've got a team.
So you have a team. Now, is that the same as the practice improvement that does for the federal reviews?
No.
Or you have a training evaluation team?
Yep.
Wow.
Okay. Anita, when you look at your data, and you start to identify outliers, I mean, doesn't that also tell you something about the individual performance?
Yeah, but I'm just not that interested in it.
Okay.
I mean, certainly we have information on it.
Right, but the information's there.
Yes.
And we look at that as well. And
which state are you from?
Michigan.
Uh-huh.
And we make some decisions based on it. And one of them might be to notify the supervisor that out of the last 100 people that have gone through the training, 98 of them passed, and yours was one of two that failed.
Okay.
You know, and then in some instances, we let then the supervisor to decide if that's a private agency, for example. In our public agency, all of the new hires are in what's called a probationary status for the first 6 months.
Uh-huh.
And so performance that's so far outside the norm, we'd probably terminate the person.
Huh. Okay. Well, I hope you don't have any lawsuits because it's going to be hard to – hopefully your test is really, really solid because it's difficult to win lawsuits. on tests unless they are, you know, like the SAT.
And that would be more of an issue if they weren't in the probationary status. We haven't had a problem at this point on that because we do also look at more than just the training in terms of the evaluation and the decision to terminate.
That's just one piece of information.
Right. And typically, again, folks that are such outliers from the norm, our experience has been there are ample additional reasons.
That's right.
That we and don't that, have to rest our entire hat on the post-test, for example.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's in our state we have a program called the Field Training Specialist, where we have people mentor senior level workers, mentor
new hires.
And so they are, and they're using a set of behavioral anchors to rate the worker across time on the key behaviors of the job, and they're supposed to meet a minimal level of competency by the end of that, and that process of teaching, both reinforcing and evaluating and giving the supervisor some sense of how this worker is doing, we found has been one of the best ways of giving feedback, because if there are value issues, we have anchors for that show up. And if they can improve, I mean, if they're improving from not having the right kind of values to having them, or being able to learn practice, not know practice skills, but being able to learn them, they're fine. But for those few people who can't seem to change any of those pieces that are critical to the job, that's been a really nice place to get the feedback to them so that the supervisors can make the right decision. And usually they're having problems across the board.
Right. Does Kentucky pay these mentors a pay differential then for that added responsibility?
No, it's just part of we make the field training people very special.
Okay.
And so they feel great, and then they tend to get promoted.
Yeah.
Because they're the best people anyway.
Right.
And then they just get extra experience doing the mentoring and coaching, and it's actually almost like a line to the supervisor. Not that formal.
Just for the other state's information. We tried to do that in Michigan, but we were not able to do that model, partly because we have a union, and it brought in a lot of complications about peers evaluating other peers and additional job duties, which the union perceived to be requiring additional compensation. So
right. In some states, Indiana pays theirs extra to do it. And so because they, when they rehauled their whole child welfare system, they built this in and they added pay to it. But yeah, unions are a whole different ballgame, and I don't have a lot of experience with that. And then finally, if you can find ways to measure the practice, and we do align our view of cases with the our continuous quality improvement process. So the scale is similar, and it does incorporate a lot of the CFSR measures because our training is aligned. Everything is aligned in our state. So, you know, it's useful to have that kind of information and to feed even our CQI data back to the training branch to let them know where people are having struggles with in different regions. But then if you can measure all those things, then you can begin to look at outcomes. Although that gets tricky because even if you have a good SACWA system, it still has a lot of bad data in it. But we've been able to have some success showing some measures that we feel pretty confident in showing some change. But you got to be very careful and have lots of history and lots of data to be able to make those linkages.
This is Susan again.
Is
anyone that you know of, or I can ask this more generally to people on the call, consistently or comprehensively trying to do the impact on outcome level evaluation? I guess that's a resounding no,
The person is going to know that.
Resounding silence.
Well, the person who's going to know that lately is Mary Collins at Boston University.
Yes.
Mary did a more recent national survey of trainers across the nation and asked about how they evaluate.
Yep.
And she's got, I can't remember, she's given it, she sent out two reports so far, and that's, I think, the third report that hasn't come out yet. But she'll be having that. People may want to contact her. It's Mary Collins at Boston University. She's got one document that does a little bit of a lit review on training evaluation and some major findings there. She's got another document on some evaluation she did of some independent living grants that the Children's Bureau gave out in 2000. And then this third document that she's preparing has data from a national evaluation that might begin to let people know how far people are and how many states do what kind of evaluation.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for sharing all your material. The whole sequence is really very helpful.
Yeah, and again, Cindy's in Montana. Cindy, you can maybe give your information or send it to Susan, because she's got a whole paper on this, on the chain of evidence, and she's got a slightly different model than we do that that spreads out those training outcomes into a lot more levels than we do.
Okay.
Yeah, in fact, that there's a couple of on the CalSWEC website, if you're interested in looking at that, there are some presentations that we've done and that are written up in proceedings that I think are available through the CalSWEC website. But I can also let Susan know some specifics if anybody would like to look at those.
Thank you, Cindy. Whatever you're willing to share, I'll be sure to distribute out to the group.
Okay. I'd love to hear what people are struggling with or what people are doing.
One question I have is, have you ever used any of these evaluation tools with parent trainings, like preparation programs for prospective foster parents or adoptive parents or intensive foster care folks? Have any of these tools been used with that group?
Yes, we have, because we've been doing in some of our federal grants training with adoptive parents, foster parents, and we've used the same measures and found similar outcomes. And we can send you, we're kind of in the middle of that work right now with the federal grants that we have where we do that training. And if you send me an email, we'll try to give you some preliminary findings.
Okay. Can you share how logistically, how you kind of go about, like, doing the pre-testing and that kind of thing, or is that sort of?
Sure. With any group, we've done it multiple ways. In the olden days, when we first started all this, we had tests in the classroom. So we give a battery test right at the beginning of the first day of training and the last day of whatever sequence, if it was 2 weeks, 4 weeks, 8 weeks, whatever the length, and give a post-test at the end of training. Then we moved to an all web-based delivery system, and that worked when the agency was supportive and would allow people to do that kind of work, given their other work in the field, and that doesn't work if the caseloads go up or if the agency isn't as supportive of data, and that's varied in Kentucky depending on the administration. And now we've got a mixture so that the pre, when they're new employees and they're kind of learning everything and pretty much do what anybody says, which is, you know, fill this out, they'll do it. And then we do the post in the classroom because by the time they get to the post, the end of new training, they're starting to get cases and they're starting to get overloaded. So we do the post now in the classroom. So we have a mixed delivery system. And again, a lot of people have found it very helpful to use, to embed it, and as they go through different modules to have tests and using those, that clicker system, because that will download the data and they can, you know, look at the numbers later. And then we've also, with our family support workers who are, we're learning everything on a computer, we just do it in Blackboard. So we've used different methods. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, thank you very much.
Okay.
And Anita, this is Kathy McIntosh in Kansas.
Uh-huh.
And we just still are so very grateful for all the things that you guys shared at the training symposium and have been able to kind of piece by piece start implementing those.
Oh, good.
And it was interesting to kind of hear trainers talk about, oh, now they needed to do some feedback about their participants and so too. But they're getting the hang of that, though.
That's
good. And I just think that that has been really useful for us, and we're starting to use the trainer observation set of worksheets too. And I just am really pleased about that. In fact, our agency has reorganized some, and so the group that is outside of Children and Family Services, where I used to work, we're very interested in looking at those too, and stuff too, in terms of looking at trainer competencies.
You want to tell the rest of the group about that and what the tool encompasses and how you've used it?
There just were several things. They provide, and it really does focus on that learner responsibility, you know, kind of builds on that piece of it. So we ask participants at the end of the course, they do a little self-assessment, and we just plug in the learning objectives for whatever course it is, and how well do they feel, how comfortable do they feel with that they can do this one. And this, you know, we say on there it's not used for personnel reasons or evaluation, but it's one way, and we ask them to take that back to their supervisor so that they can have a conversation about, you know, what are some next steps for their individual development plan.
That's great.
Now, I couldn't tell you really how well that's going across the state. I have some small stories about where that is being used. So we hope to grow on that actual good use of it. But,
that's great.
But we are starting to get it out there. That's good. And kind of letting them know that expectation has changed a little bit. The second one is for the trainers to be doing some in their observation of participants and how participants are engaged in training, their behavior and attitudes during training, then to make some notes of that. And they have just a very nice form. It's very easy, not time-consuming to do. And if there are very, you know, really standout problems, then it gives an opportunity to document that a little better. And we have had occasion where we had, I can think of two, in the same class, actually, same supervisor, actually. But it made it easier to go back to them and talk about that, and where they were very new to the agency and perhaps had not gotten a good message about what was expected of them in training. And so it was a good time for them to get that.
That's interesting that you gave feedback to the supervisor and engaged them in that process.
We're trying to really loop the supervisors in in a better way. And again, not in terms of dinging employees, but in terms of their role in supporting that individual development plan. So
that whole
developmental model, I think, just works really well for us. And then the trainer observation worksheet is just really very nice, but it helps so that we're able to observe people and are they, what's the fidelity to the content as they're delivering, you know, what's their fidelity to some of the methods that we really want them to be using, you know, and how are they meeting those expectations as trainers, and gives us a chance to provide some feedback to them.
Did you use our tool or did you create your own?
Oh, I used your tool.
Okay.
I think I had to change just a couple of little things for it to fit for Kansas, but
so we need
it
to
was
find
lovely.
A way to get that tool maybe to you, Susan, if other people are interested in what we do in Kentucky is we have senior level trainers observe all new trainers using a particular tool that looks at, again, how they manage the classroom, answer questions, their facility with the material, their ability to train using, you know, different techniques, et cetera, so that they have feedback from someone who's more seasoned and they can, you know, show improvement over time if they've got any issues. And then with our veteran trainers, again, we usually, like, the manager will come in and do some observation and give feedback. And most of our people, we hire well, and so they're really good. It's just a way to tweak one little piece or another. And with new trainers, it gives them kind of the expectations and helps lay out what's important in being a trainer. And we've weeded a few people out, but not many, using that tool if people are interested.
And we see it as just a really good way for us to really push the fidelity to content and training.
Yep.
Because that's where, as we have gone to training of trainer models in the past sometimes, and I know we're going to be doing more of that soon, that's where often things have really kind of fallen apart.
Yeah.
So that things ended up being trained very differently in different regions.
Right. And well, and the one of the other pieces that a post-test can tell you, the pre-post-test, is if people are sticking with the major goals and outcomes of the curriculum. Because if people are doing poorly on particular items, we always flag those items and go back to trainers and say, you know, what's going on here? Is it the, are you training it? Have you forgotten about it? Is it get shoved out somehow? Or is it just the people aren't getting it? So that is another way to get at fidelity, but I like to have a direct measure of it, of really looking at the curriculum and watching people in different settings to make sure that people are following it. So I'm glad that that's been helpful.
Very helpful. Thank you so much for sharing that.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I think it would be wonderful if we could get the two observation worksheets, one that the trainer does for the trainees and one that is done on the trainer. And, again, if you send those to me, I'll be happy to distribute them out to this group.
Okay. Good.
Great.
I will say, for Kansas, I'm very jealous of your whole evaluation unit.
Oh, me too, from Arizona.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, how do I do this with myself and a few trainers?
Yeah, it's hard. And, yeah, we're in a particular region of the country in terms of the ACF and the way we've got our whole consortium set up that we're able to carve out a piece of 4E to do this. And we can't promise that that could be done everywhere. Even though we've been audited a million times and it's always come out fine, the way, you know, Kentucky configures all of its training, it's hard to kind of do that across the country, unfortunately.
So. I'm wondering if anybody does have any ideas, this is Susan, about how you can begin at some of these higher-level evaluation issues without having all the rich resources that Kentucky has, and without having Anita and her talented staff. I mean, how are people doing this? Because I know some of the folks on the call are taking some really good stabs at the higher level evaluations.
Susan, is anyone using SurveyMonkey?
Yes, in Kansas, yes.
Yes, we started doing that.
And how are people using that? Talk a little bit about that.
Well, in Arizona, we do. Our university partner did that for us. They helped us. She helped us get that going a year and a half ago, and for a pre and a post self-evaluation of skills, knowledge, ability, attitude. So we have a pre and a post. It's a self-evaluation. It's not, you know, any kind of criterion or what you need to know other than, you know, what the group of people that created it felt this is something you really need to know to do this work. And that's used, and it was summarized at the end. But then we have – it didn't get perpetuated for this year. So we really need to go – it was, kind of a study that was done for a year. So what we want to do now is to go ahead and start perpetuating that again, but use it in the way that one of you was talking about earlier – to feed that information back in terms of trainee development, staff development, and what they need to know and what they might need extra help with when they need leave core. And then also looking at, if everybody is not understanding identification of child abuse, then we need to look at the trainer.
And for those that aren't familiar with SurveyMonkey, you can go to surveymonkey.com and visit their website, and it will give you lots of information about what the tool can do. In the days when we had more money in Michigan, we had an analyst that reviewed our first, second, and third level evaluations and put them together into tables and into percentages. And today, of course, we don't have very much money here in Michigan these days. And so we've adapted by using SurveyMonkey, because the nice thing about it is that if you can key in the kinds of questions to give you the information you're looking for, people can complete it at their computer. And then the website itself tabulates all your data and gives you all the comments. And so it really is a very efficient approach to collecting data.
Right.
In Kansas, I do have one person in another department, in our strategic development department, who has a PhD in statistics and who is just wonderful and loves, just can't stop herself from looking at this kind of information. She's still only available to me a small amount of time. And I'm really interested in pursuing whether we could have a student placement, you know, and try to accomplish some of this during semesters when we could have a student.
That's a great idea, Kathy. That's a great idea.
And Anita, you know, I was thinking maybe a psychology student would be a better choice for that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, because they do research.
Yeah.
Well, that's my bias, so you're going to have to forgive me, but they often know it, especially if they are in a master's or doctoral program. The undergrad, everybody takes research, but I don't know how much they actually retain it unless they're like a superstar really into it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you can get a student who's really taking lots of stats classes. Sociology also does a good job teaching statistics at, again, the master's and PhD level. So sometimes social work does. It just depends on the school and the faculty and
really
student interest. It really just depends. Cindy, you may have ed psych, too.
Yeah, my bias is ed psych.
Yeah. but that's right, because they have more of the psychometrics.
Yeah, I think you probably could use a couple of things because that psychometric piece is really important. The SurveyMonkey and the Clicker system and all those things will help tabulate data for you. But what you really need, too, is somebody who understands test construction and scale construction and can write good items or know a good item when they see it.
And that really is the skill I need because it takes a lot of time for me to do that, and probably somebody better skilled could do it faster. And it is still just me, so.
Yeah. Well,
and the other thing with SurveyMonkey is it would be useful, I think, for you to have somebody with more of a statistical background to look at some of the assumptions it makes when it cranks out those analyses.
Mm-hmm.
We used it this year, and it does things like it doesn't count non-respondents. It didn't handle non-respondents the same way I would an analysis. So keep an eye on stuff like that.
Oh, that's good to know.
Yeah.
But one of the things, too, that I've done with item writing, because I think even for people who do it professionally, it's just a grind, is have people, either trainers or people who really know the content, write some and then save sort of the psychometrician to provide feedback to existing items. Or the other thing is, you know, sometimes just throw out some open-ended items and see what people say because it's a great source of wrong answers for you.
Yeah. That's true. But a lot of states are using, even if it's not a lot of money, they have some kind of partnership with the universities. And so if they can, you know, entice people to gather the information or work in partnership and, you know, it could be a publication for a person at a university, even if they're not getting a lot of pay for it, those partnerships can be very important. And sometimes in the good times you can pay more, and the bad times you don't pay as much, but at least there's that relationship. And a lot of states have that relationship between the university and the state. What are other people doing in terms of training evaluation? Any other states want to say anything?
Well, Anita, excuse me, this is Lori Hurst from the Child Welfare Institute in Rhode Island. And we do sort of a similar thing, except we don't go to the level of observing trainers because we have not enough staff to do that at the moment. But but that's something we do aspire to. But we do in our pre-service program for new workers. We do have multiple levels of evaluation. Obviously, the training itself, the training event is evaluated. And then we also have, similar to I assume, your observation of participants, we have all of our trainers fill out a similar form. Yeah, and that feedback does get to the supervisor, obviously for the purpose of measuring their learning during their probationary period. And we, recently implemented a sort of a pilot individual training needs assessment process And the jury's still out about how that's going to play out and whether it's going to, in fact, be helpful in determining training needs, both during the pre-service or probationary period and then beyond.
Mm-hmm.
But we are implementing that at the moment, so that's sort of what we're doing here.
That's great.
Yeah, and I mean, my head's exploding with so many ideas from your discussion today and everybody else's contributions.
Yeah.
So I've got volumes of notes, but
good.
Yeah, but it's very helpful.
It's a process, and remember, it took us a number of years in Kentucky to build a relationship to get people over the fear of evaluation, to build these different components. A lot of times we've done things with our federal grants first, shown how it can work, and then they've implemented it at the state level. So there's lots of ways to get this done, and it does take a long time. And some states have been able to pull in people like Cindy and others as consultants to help set things up. And so there's lots of ways to do this. And people should just see it as here's the big picture, and there's how can we kind of hack away at it.
Right.
And do as much as we can, you know, along the way.
Yeah. One thing I am curious about is in terms of, and I'm sorry, I forget who was presenting the information from their state about the assessments that they do, the self-assessment based on learning and observation
Kansas.
Of participants. Was it Kansas? Okay.
Uh-huh.
Do you do that for your in-service programs too? Or is that just for your new worker?
That to Kansas?
Yes.
I'm doing that on most of our courses. We hire all BSWs.
Mm-hmm.
They're all licensed social workers to start with. But as I said, that does not mean they are, you know, educated about child welfare practices or issues really at all. And so we're using it across the board with those. So it doesn't matter to me if they're new or if they're veteran. And we're using it on, last week we started with a new class. I don't use it on every class, okay? On some of the shorter ones, I may not do that. On some of the, I may not do all of those. On some of the bigger ones that are kind of bigger initiatives, you know, I'll do much more of that. Last week was our first pilot of a class that we actually got from Butler, their specialized interviewing skills course. And so we had actors in to help play the roles for the practice interviews. And that was, we do 2 days of that, one with a just general child abuse and neglect sort of concern and one on sexual abuse, to give them a little more practice with the protocol that we're wanting used across the board and, you know, practice with some peer review and feedback on that too. So we've just benefited from everybody's gifts, and we're happy to take more.
Great.
Have people done more evaluation as a result of all the PIPs that happened? Because I know that training was in every PIP, and I wondered if people had some chances to do some evaluation of all that training that went on for the PIPs, or if that's just a moot point at this point.
Hi, this is Oscar Morgan. In Idaho, we've developed a couple of things. One of them is that in terms of we have a small shop here, just myself and my boss, and so we coordinate and work through university partners of Boise State and Eastern Washington University, and we actually have what's called a partnership of Casey, our Department of Health and Welfare, and our university partners, and actually that's where we grab a lot of our or the majority of our trainers for our academy process. What we put together is a competency-based learning contract, which has all the different 24 courses within that. And in the process of working with that new worker, they go through a continuous learning plan where we have them complete and go out and work with their supervisor on specific areas post-training. Of course, we're getting feedback, and we've got an evaluator from Eastern Washington University who's a PhD and kind of leads up our evaluation efforts. But what we do is the individual will work with their supervisor and establish things they're going to work on post-training, as well as things that supervisor feels are important other learning expectations. And then we actually have them go through a process of working on those things and being evaluated. They self-evaluate, and then they have their supervisor self-evaluate. And we're moving a step beyond that right now is that we're actually having focus groups with all our supervisors in terms of how this contract, this competency-based learning contract is working, how our academy process is working. So we're continually trying to build We had like
That's
a one-week academy and, of course, got killed, you know. And so we're due back in for the CFSR in April. And we moved this up to almost 24 days of
training.
Okay,
good. Good for you.
Yeah, so we're moving.
Good. That's great. It sounds really good. I love the idea of kind of having the consumer feedback of the supervisors, how well has this all gone, because they are our customers.
And we're also getting feedback from the individual that goes to the academy in terms of how much is my supervisor supporting me. And then we're passing that information on if we're having problems, because I agree with from the beginning of the session today in terms of if it's not sold or the what's in it for me, you're dead in the water.
Good.
I really like that competency-based learning contract idea.
Mm-hmm.
This is Susan, and I'm very sorry to do this, but our time is... This has been just a fabulous call. I want to thank everyone, Anita, you especially, for launching us and keeping us going, joining in. Cindy, the other day I was out at an event at the regional office, Region 5 in Chicago, and we were talking about the evaluation you did, Cindy, of the MEPA program in California delivered online and in the classroom. Mm-hmm. So your name came up then very positively, because people didn't think anybody had ever done any evaluation on distance learning, and so I credited you for doing that, and thank you for sharing today. And everyone else who shared, great. This has been a fabulous call. I have on my list that several people are going to send me things, observation worksheets, and information if you're doing any videos that related to hiring. Whatever I receive over the next week or so, I'll put in an email out to everyone who's on our list. And I have on my next step item to contact Frida Bernatovich and Michelle Graff and invite them to join our next peer training call, which will be in January, and we'll ask them to share with us some information on what they've learned about ways to hire, because that seems to be the start of the training evaluation process. So with that said, thank you, everyone. This has been fabulous. Anita, thank you. Cindy,
thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
It was fun.
I really appreciate all the information you shared today. This has been a call above and beyond expectations.
Thanks,
everybody.
Stay warm and dry.
Yeah.
Okay,
everybody.
If you're in the southeast.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Socks.